to Day On Against the Grain. Can white people truly grasp how deeply racism is embedded in U.S. society and in people's psyches? I'm CS. David Mura talks about his new book, The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself, Racial Myths in Our American Narratives, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. If the project, if the goal, is to eradicate racism in the U.S., a huge obstacle, according to David Mura, is white identity and the investment white people have in that identity. White people, Mura asserts in his new book, tell themselves stories about race, stories that make them feel good, but often leave out the voices and narratives of non-whites. Much of Mura's focus is on James Baldwin, whose essays, Mura notes, explored why actual equality, which entails the recognition of Black Americans as equals, is so difficult for white Americans to even begin to address. Baldwin and many other writers, including Toni Morrison, William Faulkner, and Alex Pate, figure prominently in Mura's new book, The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself, Racial Myths and Our American Narratives. David Mura is a Minneapolis-based writer, critic, poet, and playwright. When David and I connected recently, I asked what he saw as his book's mission.
I want people to understand that race in America and the way it affects our society takes place at a far deeper level in the way we think, in the way we form our identities, and in the complex workings of our society. And that the attempt to simplify race or to define racism in ways which essentially erase the existence of racism are tools of whiteness and the maintenance of white supremacy.
And how do you define whiteness? You use that term with a capital W throughout your text. What is whiteness?
Whiteness, as I use it, is an ideology. And by that I mean it is a set of ideas, beliefs, rules, and practices which establish white supremacy in America and establish the difference between what it meant to be white and what it meant to be Black, and continued those ideas, beliefs, rules, and practices throughout our history, and which continues the maintenance of white supremacy and racism in our society. And it forms, in many ways, the identities of white people, the way they think about their social reality, the way they think about their identities, the ways they interpret what happens to them, their experiences, and what goes on in this society. And many white people don't really understand how deeply this identity structures their consciousness, their beliefs, and how they react to the world.
What does white identity have to do with the way that whites, the way that you think whites understand history, their version of and their vision of history, the history of this country, this area?
Well, in my introduction, I talk about how America began with two goals. One was to establish freedom, equality, and democracy. And the second goal, which in many ways is contradictory to the first goal, was the establishment of white supremacy and the ability of white people to rule over and discriminate against people of color. And America, white America, is fine with telling the tale of our history through the pursuit of the first goal of equality, freedom, and democracy, and through telling this tale of our history through sort of unblemished white heroes, through erasing or mitigating the dominance and effects of racism in our history. And you can see this, obviously, for instance, in what Governor Ron DeSantis is doing in Florida, and the banning of the AP African American Histories course. And throughout now, you see throughout the United States, you see organizations like Moms for Liberty really trying to erase the history of America in terms of what Black Americans have experienced, what their narratives are, and how integral they have been to the history of this country, and therefore how integral the experience of Black Americans and what they have suffered is to what white people have done and who they have been and who they are in the present.
And why is white America, or the vast majority of white America, or the majority of white America, you can clarify that for me, why is it so resistant to looking at what white supremacy and what white people have done to African Americans and people of color over the course of many centuries?
White people are resistant against looking at whiteness for many complex reasons. Place I would start would be their identity as white people, or the way they think of their role in the world. Baldwin wrote that the question of identity is a question inducing the most profound panic, a terror as primary as the nightmare of the mortal fall. And by that he meant, you know, to question one's identity is really as scary as contemplating the fact that one is mortal, one is going to die. And he says that identities change in societies only when the mighty begin to fall or the wretched begin to rise, as in revolutions, or when the stranger enters the gates, thereafter making you the stranger, less to the stranger than to yourself. And by this he means that when a stranger walks into your village, suddenly you're introduced to somebody who may speak a different language, who worships different gods, who looks at the world very differently than you do, and looks at you very differently than the way you look at yourself. And Baldwin says that there's a resistance to changing one's identity. And what allows one to change one's identity is this idea that identity should be, and I'm quoting Baldwin now, a little like the robes of the desert through which one's nakedness can sometimes be discerned and always felt. This belief in one's nakedness is all that gives one the power to change one's robes. So we think our identities, as we've defined it, or so we think about it, is who we are. And it's not. What Baldwin says is the identity is like a robe we put on. And underneath, we're naked, fallible people. We don't know everything. We're mortal. We're not omniscient. And therefore, this belief in our fallibility is what ought to give us the power to change one's robes, to question our identity. Now, the thing is that people have built up a stake in this identity, and we see this very obviously in this moment in American history where, again, as has happened very often in our history, there is a huge movement of racial regression. Up until recently, white identity in the post-civil rights era has been mainly hidden. And what whites have done in that period is said, well, let's not even think about race. Any talk about race is racism, so no one has a racial identity. So we as whites don't have a racial identity. And then what happened was Obama was elected president. And suddenly the white population was aware, became aware, oh, we can have a black person in charge. What is going to happen to us? And it made the white population much more aware of the fact that after 2040, we will no longer have a white majority in this country. Every group will be a racial minority. And there's a significant portion of the white population that is freaking out over this. And that is why you have the rise of MAGA America, where their idea of making America great again is very much tied to an earlier era where they could espouse and imprint white supremacy on this society without much resistance and define America simply as a white nation. So that is a dealing with what I would call white conservatives and white Republicans. But the other aspect of white identity tends to show itself even in liberals and in the way they look at race. And I talk about this in terms of the way fiction writers portray their characters. But one of the rules of whiteness is that takes place on the level of epistemology, of knowledge. And in the rules of whiteness, white knowledge is always valid, objective, true, and official, while black knowledge is always invalid, subjective, false or suspicious, and unofficial, unless white people declare it's official. And you see this rule of white supremacy of knowledge in all areas of the society. You see it in the legal system, you see it in the educational system, you see it in the healthcare system, and you see it in my own field of creative writing, where certain ideas about how creative writing should be taught or what the standard canon is tends to either neglect or marginalize the writings and thinkings and traditions of writers of color in the name of supposedly objective criteria for judging literature.
David Murra is my guest on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. His new book is The Stories Whiteness Tells Us, Racial Myths and Our American Narratives, and it's published by the University of Minnesota Press. We agreed to go into some depth into some of the book where you talk about Baldwin, and you've mentioned Baldwin, and you're very influenced by James Baldwin, and you believe that much of what he said really still applies to today. So, you know, this is decades and decades ago, and much of what he says, in your opinion, about race relations and racism and systemic racism do still apply. You begin the first chapter with something Baldwin wrote about the rumor that instigated the Harlem riots of 1943. I wonder, because Baldwin was born and raised in Harlem and wrote about the riots, and he actually wrote about his father's death in the context of the riots. But what struck you about Baldwin's description of his account of the riots?
So in his essay, Notes of a Native Son, when he's speaking about the cause of the riots of 1943 in Harlem, he talks about a rumor in which a Negro soldier got into a fight with a white policeman over a Negro girl. And the rumor was that the policeman had shot the soldier in the back. Now, this was not true. He was not dead, although they did have a fight. And what Baldwin says is that the truth of this rumor or not is not really the true cause of the riots, that the riots were caused by the conditions under which the black residents of Harlem had been living for years. The segregation, the economic deprivation, the police harassment, and the rumor was simply a spark to ignite this long-standing and seething anger which the black residents had been feeling for years. And one of the reasons why I'm quoting Baldwin on this is that you saw the exact same thing, for instance, in the riots that occurred in Ferguson, Missouri, when a unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, was shot and killed by a policeman. Now, what people didn't understand was that the financing of the Ferguson Police Department did not take place through taxes, through property taxes, as happens in most municipalities. Instead, it was funded by the legal fees that came from tickets, that came from fines for missing court appearances, or if you didn't pay a fine, you were assessed a further fine. And so in many ways, the police department of Ferguson operated as this marauding band whose very existence and salaries depended upon their constantly arresting black citizens, often for simply the crime of driving while black. And so the citizens of Ferguson were not just reacting to the unjustified killing of Michael Brown, but for years of living under this system of police oppression, where the police sort of acted, I believe, like a band of brigands extracting their living from the citizens of Ferguson. And so what Baldwin is constantly saying is, you know, and he says in the essay, he's also, another essay, he says, you know, as long as there are what he calls ghettos, or places where a population is segregated and forced to live in unequal conditions, the police who are patrolling that area will constantly be looked at as invaders. And indeed, on the opposite side of that, in the beginning of my book, I start with the killing of Philando Castile in a suburb of St. Paul that took place in 2017. The killing of Philando Castile is something which, again, demonstrates how black residents of this country, when they encounter the legal system, are constantly endangered and face unequal treatment and discrimination. And one of the things that people don't realize about, say, about Philando Castile was that in 10 years, he was stopped officially over 50 times in 10 years by the police. His mother says it was more like 80 times because some of the stops were not registered. And so Philando Castile must have felt as if he was constantly being hounded by the police, which he was.
So Baldwin's focus then is on the context, and you are then trying to say that, you know, because there is a lot of focus on the specific circumstances of the murder of Michael Brown, or the murder of Philando Castile, or so on, so on. You're saying that we have to look beyond that. We have to look at the rage that is caused by a systemic issue, and that, you know, occasionally bursts to the surface in relation to events like this, but is far more than an isolated murder here, an isolated murder there. Is that fair to say?
Yes. And one of the things I write about in the essay of Philando Castile is that I realized that in order to understand what happened on this street not more than 3 miles from my home, we have to go back in American history and understand how the categories of whiteness and blackness were created, what meanings were assigned to them, and particularly in the period after the Civil War, when blacks were supposedly freed from slavery. And during that period, there was a question then of what was the role of blacks as citizens? Could blacks be citizens? Now, in the South, in Reconstruction and afterwards, there was a complete and entire effort by the entire society to essentially reestablish many of the practices and certainly the suppression of black rights as citizens. And one of the methods in which this was done was to assign to blackness the stain of criminality. And in the 19th century, there were studies, pseudo-scientific studies, because these were falsely scientific, where any crime committed by a black person was evidence of the criminality of the entire black race. And in these same studies, when a white person committed a crime, it was simply attributed to that individual and oftentimes explained by socioeconomic conditions. So back then, even there, you have two very different scientific criteria applied to a black person committing a crime and a white person committing the crime. At the same time, in the South, what you have is the establishment of the black codes and laws, which established that a black person could be arrested if they were not literally actually working for a white person, not just by the police at any time, but by any white person. So it essentially criminalized black people when they were not actually working for white people. So the effect of that law on the way people looked at black people, the effect of these pseudoscientific studies of black criminality became established in the culture, and the equation of blackness and criminal, almost a genetic criminal trait, became embedded in American culture and certainly embedded in the way whites think about blacks. And of course, then you see this obviously in the evidence of police. Right? I mean, we know, for instance, that blacks and whites smoke marijuana at exactly the same rate. But blacks are 3.64 times, and sometimes in cases even more, more likely to be arrested for using marijuana, you know, for the exact same crimes as whites.
Well, James Baldwin, he was very attentive, of course, to what was happening in black communities around the U.S. while he was alive. And he asked the question of whether white America wanted black poverty and racial segregation to exist. And how did he answer that question?
Well, he answered the conditions of black America are exactly what white America wants them to be. If white America wanted the conditions of African Americans to be equal, to have equal opportunity, they would have allowed it. And so he says the existence of the Harlem ghetto, a term that he uses, he says, is entirely the result of what white people wanted to do to the black population. If the white population wanted to eradicate black poverty, if they wanted to eradicate the injustice of the legal system, they would actually do so.
David Murrah joins us on Against the Grain. He is a Minneapolis-based writer, critic, poet, and playwright. We are talking about his new book. It's called The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself, Racial Myths in Our American Narratives. David's last name is spelled M-U-R-A. And I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. This context that you're talking about, this context which generates rage among black residents, African-American residents in urban areas and in other areas of the U.S. and around the world, this context in which black Americans live, if someone were to try to grasp that context, to understand it, that, you write, would make the character of any individual black person fully human and comprehensible. Do white Americans want to understand that context? Do they have a desire, at least, to understand that context?
I think that white Americans both want to understand the context of black America, but to a large extent, they don't want to know. One of the ways that this occurs, as I said earlier, is in the evaluation of knowledge. Because if white knowledge is always valid, objective, true, and official, and black knowledge is always invalid, subjective, false, suspicious, and unofficial, what it means is that the narratives and consciousness of black Americans are always deemed suspicious. And the way white people want to tell the history of our country or the nature of our present-day racial reality, in almost all white people's minds, remains superior and remains the official judgment. Now, this is in direct contradistinction to the fact that in our racial history, the majority of white people have always been wrong on racial issues, whether on slavery, whether on the existence of Jim Crow, whether on the civil rights laws and the integration of America. And black people have always been on the right side of history. And so even though black people have demonstrated throughout our history a superior grasp of equality and the problems of race, white America has never turned to Black America and said, you know, we got it wrong in every period of our history, and you got it right. Maybe we ought to follow your lead. Maybe we ought to listen to you. And for many white people, that is impossible for them to say.
Now, Baldwin, and I keep returning to Baldwin because that is a main focus of your book. He wrote about his father. His father was abusive toward him and his mother. His father felt a lot of bitterness. What did Baldwin write about the bitterness that his father felt, the cause of that bitterness, and what Baldwin felt about that bitterness possibly affecting him, becoming part of him?
Well, it's very interesting because Baldwin's father was not his biological father, and he did not find this out till he was an adult. His father would say things like, "You are the ugliest child I've ever seen." And he treated Baldwin very badly. And his father was very bitter about the racism in American society. And Baldwin, in part in reaction to the negative relationship he had with his father, saw that as a defect of his father, that his father was not successful as a preacher, was not successful in life. And there was part of the young Baldwin that said, well, he's just using racism as an excuse. Now, Baldwin grew up in Harlem, and he was aware that racism existed because he was aware of the unjust treatment of Black residents by the police. But it was only during World War II, when he moved out of Harlem and worked in a factory in New Jersey, that he came in contact with racial discrimination and segregation in a very different way, in a more marked way. And he would go to restaurants, and at first he went to this diner and would pick up his order of a hamburger, and it was only after a few times that he realized that they never intended to serve him. He was picking up somebody else's hamburger. This happened once, and he got so enraged that he went to this really fancy white restaurant, a place he knew he wouldn't be served, and he's dragging this white friend who's following him as Baldwin storms into the restaurant in anger and sits down at a table. And the waitress comes up to him and says, "We don't serve Negroes here." And he asks her to bend down a little, and she, you know, because he goes, "I didn't hear you." And she won't bend down, but she says, "We don't serve Negroes here." And he takes a glass and he throws it at her, and she ducks and it hits the bar. And the whole restaurant stops. And he immediately realizes, oh, Jesus, I got to get out of here. He tries to run out. This burly waitress tries to stop him, and he gets out, and he runs away, and his white friend directs the crowd in the opposite direction. But Baldwin realizes after this that the racial bitterness and anger that was in his father also resides in him.
And in this regard, I wonder if you could read a quote from one of Baldwin's, I imagine, essays that you reproduce on page 224 of your book that begins that year in New Jersey.
Yes. Later in the essay, Baldwin writes this: "That year in New Jersey lives in my mind as though it were the year during which, having an unsuspected predilection for it, I first contracted some dread chronic disease. The unfailing system of which is a kind of blind fever, a pounding in the skull and fire in the bowels. Once this disease is contracted, one can never really be carefree again, for the fever, without an instant's warning, can recur at any moment. It can wreck more important things in race relations. There is not a Negro alive who does not have this rage in his blood. One has the choice merely of living with it consciously or surrendering to it. As for me, this fever recurred in me and does and will until the day I die." And after this incident in the restaurant, Baldwin realized that either he was going to kill somebody or get himself killed or kill himself if he remained in America. And he went to France. And later in the essay, he says, you know, you can't really hate white people, because if you hate white people, you end up destroying your own soul. But he says you can't really quite love white people for everything that they do to you. And he says that the black citizen is faced with this dilemma of finding some way out of this rage. And as Baldwin progressed in his life, he began to understand how to do this in a very complex way.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. David Murrah joins us. His books include A Stranger's Journey, Race, Identity, and Narrative Craft in Writing, and the memoirs Turning Japanese, Memoirs of Asanse, and Where the Body Meets Memory, An Odyssey of Race, Sexuality, and Identity. We are talking about his new book, The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself, Racial Myths in Our American Narratives. Yeah, so if the question for Baldwin is, how does a black person such as himself maintain their sanity and their psychological equilibrium in the face of a brutal and brutally racist system, or put another way, how does that person survive and not be destroyed, right, by anger, by bitterness, by a desire for revenge? How does Baldwin resolve that? How does he answer that question, at least for himself?
He answers it in a very complex way, but one way I summarize that is, you know, recently there was a movie on Baldwin called I Am Not Your Negro. And in it, he actually uses the N-word, and he says, you know, when somebody calls me the N-word, it doesn't affect me, because he says it doesn't say anything about me. It says something about white people and the fact that they use it and they made it up. But Baldwin says it says nothing about me. And oftentimes what I tell younger people of color is that part of your spiritual and psychological recovery from racism in this society is to make whiteness smaller inside your head, is to make the judgments and discriminations by white society and white people matter less to the way you think about yourself. Now, the way Baldwin did this was very complex. One aspect of it was in terms of learning more about black people in the South. And during the Civil Rights Movement, he went down to the South and saw the spiritual courage and equanimity with which the nonviolent protesters faced the brutal racism of the South. You know, police hoses, police beatings, dogs. And they were able to maintain their spiritual equanimity and psychological equanimity because of their faith. But Baldwin also said that when he was in the South, he ran around looking in the eyes of old black women and old black men. And he saw in those eyes a sort of wisdom and a resilience, saying to him, we have seen far worse than you have, and we have survived. And in one of his essays, he talks about going to a restaurant in the South and walking in the front door and told, no, we serve Negroes out in the back. And rather than, as he did when he was younger, he doesn't react with rage and bitterness and throw something against the wall. He just goes out to the back and he finds this older black man eating at a table out back outside the restaurant. And he looked at this old black man and he saw, like, this man is not going to let the racism around him destroy his meal, is not going to dwell on the racism around him in order to survive this moment. And he saw in this older black man, again, a resiliency, a strength that has allowed blacks in the South to survive a horribly unjust system of racism.
He saw this strength, he saw this resilience on the part of African Americans. He also noted, this is Baldwin, he was struck by how weak he perceived white people to be. Weak in what way?
The weakness he saw in white people was that they believed in their whiteness. They somehow believed that their whiteness made them important in the world and made them superior. And he saw that this whiteness was based on, in part, a ridiculous belief about American history.
In one chapter of your book, David, you examine Steven Spielberg's film, Amistad, in relation to a novelization of that film. And that novelization was written, this man, a black novelist named Alex Pate, who was a friend of yours, he was commissioned by Spielberg's production studio DreamWorks to write the novelization of the film Amistad, basing the work on the film's script. Can you describe what you see as a difference, as the difference, between the way the novel turned out and the way the film turned out, and the scriptwriters, the two scriptwriters of the film, the two main scriptwriters were white. What the difference or the contrast is or was that you're trying to identify, and how this relates to your understanding of the difference between black understandings and white understandings?
Yes. Now, Spielberg has adopted black children. He's a white liberal. I think he created the film in order to promote racial progress and understanding. But at the beginning of the film, we see the Africans in chains, and they break their chains. But as they speak, there's no subtitles. We don't understand them. Spielberg could easily have put subtitles, right? So they are unintelligible. Their first act is killing the Spanish sailors who have them in prison. So the first act is an act of violence. And since we don't have a context for this, we could think these are prisoners revolting and killing their guards. We don't know. And then after they take over the ship, they try to get the Spanish sailors to sail them back to Africa, and the Spanish sailors trick them and sail them to America, where there is a court case to judge whether they are free men or slaves. Now, my friend Alex Pate, a novelist, looked at this opening of the film, and he said, I can't start the novel here. And so he starts it in Africa, and he starts it in the head of consciousness of Sinke, so that he is not unintelligible. We understand his thoughts and feelings. And the first scene of the novel is Sinke is sleeping with his wife and child. So he is not a man of violence. He is sleeping with his wife and child. He has a culture. He has a language. And a lion comes and attacks the village, and Sinke kills the lion. And so his first act of violence is an act of heroism of saving his village. But the other thing that happens is that in Africa, Sinke is not black. There is no black and white. Or as Du Bois said in his essay, famous essay, The Souls of Black Folks, what does it mean to be a problem? Well, when Sinke is in Africa, being black is not a problem. And he doesn't have to go to white people to adjudicate whether he is a free man or a slave. And so my friend Alex starts the novel outside of the categories of blackness and whiteness, outside of the ontology of whiteness. He tells the novel as much as he can through the mind and consciousness of Sinke, the black African, whereas in the movie, the figures of prominence are the young lawyer played by Matthew McConaughey and John Quincy Adams. Even Spielberg's friend David Geffen said it's a white savior movie. And so even though my friend Alex had to use the same script, he created a completely different novel with a completely different sense of racial categories and who is the hero. So if you have a different hero, you have a different goal, you have a completely different narration.
And what does it say to you that what we might call a well-meaning white person like Spielberg, what does it mean to you that he didn't present this story of Amistad, this slave ship chronicle, from an African-American point of view like Alex Pate did? What does that say to you about white people's ability to get outside of the white frame of reference?
I think it is very difficult for most white people at present to get out of the confines of their white identity. In order to do that, they have to do very conscious work. Now, one of the things I say when speaking about race all the time in this country is, I'm not here to shame or guilt people. And I think we change people not through shame or guilt, but through knowledge and love. But what I want white people to understand is there are many things about race that they don't know. And indeed, there are things about race that I don't know and that anybody in America doesn't know. And we don't know what we don't know. So that we should always be open to learning more and opening to questioning our assumptions about race and the way we look at the world. That's very hard sometimes for white people to do because they said, well, the way I look at the world just makes sense to me. And the only way you understand it doesn't make sense if you begin to understand the parts of history that American history leaves out, which is the consciousness, experience, and narratives of Black Americans and other Americans of color. And only when you begin to do that will you begin to see that there's a whole other way of viewing America, of viewing white people, of viewing Black people, of viewing other people of color, which you have not learned in school, which you have not learned from the culture, which you have not learned even from well-meaning liberal directors like Steven Spielberg. And unless you do this questioning, you will never begin to dismantle some of the unconscious assumptions that you have about race and the implicit bias that you might have that you're not even aware that you have.
The book is The Stories Whiteness Tells Itself, Racial Myths in Our American Narratives. The author, our guest, is David Murra, M-U-R-A. He is a Minneapolis-based poet, critic, writer, and playwright. His other books include A Stranger's Journey and We Are Meant to Rise, Voices for Justice from Minneapolis to the World, co-edited with Carolyn Holbrook. David, thanks for writing this book and for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, C.S. I really enjoyed this.
And this is Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. In the time remaining, we'll present portions of an interview I did with Elizabeth J. Friedman, portions we did not have time to air last week. Elizabeth J. Friedman, a University of San Francisco professor, joined me to describe how Ni Una Menos, an influential feminist formation in Argentina, managed to build an intergenerational mass movement by attracting younger women and girls to its ranks. I asked Elizabeth whether the metaphor of the wave, sometimes used to describe movements, such as, for example, second wave and third wave feminism, whether it made sense to use that metaphor in relation to feminist activism she has studied in Latin America.
Thanks. That's, again, such an important and insightful question in terms of a metaphor that is so widely used that it's hard to talk about it, even to critique it, without first centering it. It is the shorthand for talking about feminist history, not only in the United States, but I've heard it used across Latin America as well, even while they may define their waves in terms of different historical periods. So the wave metaphor is definitively used to try to do that, to show when there have been upsurges in women's organizing over time. But those upsurges, it's not just used to sort of identify that more people are active in the streets, for example, but it ends up reducing the size, the scope, and the location of feminist activism, because if a particular kind of activism doesn't take place, say from 1968 to 1982, then it isn't seen as feminist and as sort of got to be something else, for example, if we're talking about second wave. So the wave metaphor really compresses and reduces, again, who is a feminist and what is seen as feminism to a particular issue at a particular time. And So that's a general critique that has been made by many, many feminist activists and scholars, definitely not unique to us. I think where we build on that critique is to say that another thing that having discrete waves does is imply that there are discrete generations for each wave. And so that's really going to obscure any kind of intergenerational bleeding, if you will, over the margins of those particular waves. So it's harder to literally see that there's intergenerational activism going forward if you're stuck in this metaphor or worldview of seeing distinct times and places and issues and people as the feminism of that time. So it becomes that sort of sequential order of distinct cohorts with different styles. And since that's not what we see here, we are much more open to these sort of aqueous metaphors that, I mean, the wave, of course, is an aqueous metaphor itself, but the idea is here comes a wave, a big wave, it rises up and then it crashes down and recedes, right? But other aqueous metaphors, like streams, perhaps, that find different branches, or that a river that overflows its banks and then things become drier, but it keeps going forward and you always know where it was, right? You could think of it that way. But the metaphor that is used predominantly in Latin America now is of the marea verde, which translates to the green tide. And this is a green tide that these days is very identified with reproductive justice, and particularly the struggle for legal or decriminalized, even socially decriminalized, abortion. But the color green and people wearing green kerchiefs is something that has also been seen as the opposition to feminicide and all forms of gender-based violence. There's also people who, and Ni Una Menos itself really took on various shades of pink and violet. But in any case, to go back to the Marea Verde, the green tide, and they talk about it as a tide because the tide comes up and goes down and comes up and goes down. You're more aware of it in some places in the ocean than others. But together we are part of a tide, I think they think, that will cover society, that will cover the region, if not the globe, with their demands and hopefully response to those demands.
Elizabeth J. Friedman had this to say about how young women and girls were brought into Ni Una Menos and about the directions in which she saw younger feminists moving.
I think some of this was, I wouldn't say exactly serendipity, because it was the outcome of decades of work in debating, developing ideas, figuring out strategies, hammering on the doors of power over and over again, but also decades of work in making sure that there were spaces open for debate, dissension, development, creativity, where younger generations could eventually see that there was a space for them, that space was also for them. But I have to say that in the research that Ana Laura and I are doing now, that focuses even more closely on the protagonism of the younger generations of feminists themselves, that they definitively came into these spaces and then, yes, continued to develop their own challenging and inspiring takes on the way the world works and what must be done. And I'll just leave you with a teaser of one of the things we found, which is that at least in amongst the young women we included in terms of the interviews, they give themselves different names in terms of how they define themselves as feminists. Some of them consider that they are feminists. Others of them call themselves popular feminists, which in the United States we might translate to grassroots feminists, that is focused on the needs and demands of people at economic, racial, and ethnic margins of society. And the third group defines themselves as trans feminists. Now, these aren't exclusionary categories to the young people who define themselves as such, but to us, it's this remarkable development in terms of their very identities, where they are continuing to transform what feminism means. And it's building on that transformation that we see the future of Ni Una Menos and other mass feminist movements in Argentina and across Latin America. And we can't wait to see what this generation is going to do next.
Elizabeth J. Friedman is professor of politics and Latin American studies at the University of San Francisco. She joined me to discuss an article she co-authored with Ana Laura Rodriguez Gusta, titled Welcome to the Revolution, Promoting Generational Renewal in Argentina's Ni Una Menos, which appeared in the journal Qualitative Sociology. And I'm CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.